Welcome to Season 2 of Level With Us, where we'll be taking even deeper dives into the root causes and the intersecting issues of Central Ohio's housing crisis. Whether you're a first-time listener or a follower of the pod, thank you for lending your ears to an effort that is desperate for more attention, more voices, and more action. Everyone is affected by our housing shortage, whether you're a homeowner, a renter, a landlord, or someone experiencing homelessness or housing instability. And all of us have a role to play in fixing it. So here in Season 2, I'm bringing on more experts, community organizers, and leaders that I hope inspire more of you to find out what that role is. How does your home, the block you live on, or your broader neighborhood affect your health? Dr. Anthony B. Eitan from Healthy Communities at the California Endowment gave us this quote, "When it comes to your health, your zip code matters more than your genetic code." Across America, average life expectancies in certain communities are 20 to 30 years shorter than those mere miles away, according to the National Institutes of Health. These health disparities are founded on a complex interplay of racial, economic, educational, and other social factors. For today's episode, I'm using a recent paper written by local researchers to examine how policy, including housing policies, impact the health of our neighborhoods. This paper, which is called A History of the Impacts of Discriminatory Policies on Housing and Maternal and Infant Health in an Ohio Neighborhood, which from here on out I'll refer to as the Linden paper, zooms in on the Linden area, which sits east of Clintonville with I-71 as its western barrier. One of the paper's co-authors joins me for this episode, Dr. Kiara Barnett, Senior Research Scientist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. With her is Nick Jones, Nationwide Children's Hospital Vice President for Community Wellness, which leads the Healthy Neighborhoods Healthy Families Initiative. We'll dive more into Healthy Neighborhoods Healthy Families later in the episode, but to start, a bit of background on Dr. Barnett's paper. The Linden paper is part of a larger research study called the TIME Study, or Targeted Investment in Meaningful Engagement. It's an NIH effort to fund research that addresses structural racism as a root cause of health inequities. As such, the paper gives an outline of how structural racism was built into policy locally, how those policies shaped Linden, and how they have led to the health disparities we see in the neighborhood today.
There's a 100-year history of Linden.
This is Dr. Kiara Barnett.
And, years of different policies, different practices that have led to the community, Linden that was once a predominantly homeowner-based community to being more renters now, that's policy, right? Yeah. A lot of that came in the housing crisis in 2008 and the subprime loans that folks had. And really just want to just outline that history for us to better understand what's happened to this community. Because I think oftentimes when we see disparities, it's really easy for us to blame individuals for the outcomes they have. And this paper is one that says, okay, let's step back though, and let's look at, from a policy standpoint, how has this community come to be? Because it's not just people not caring about themselves or their community, because what we know about Linden is they have a lot of pride and they care about themselves and their community. So it's really about what has policy, or how has policy impacted this community?
The Linden paper discusses everything from the racial deed restrictions of the 1920s. These are private agreements between buyers and sellers, written within deeds, barring non-whites from occupying or owning the property, to the blockbusting and highway construction in the 50s and 60s, remember I-71 is one of Linden's borders, all the way to the subprime lending crisis in the aughts and tens. More than 50% of all home loans made in Linden were subprime loans. And the subsequent foreclosure crisis destabilized the neighborhood, increasing vacancy rates from 11.4% in 2000 to 22.1% in 2016. But how does any of this affect the health of a community presently? And importantly, the health of that community's infants and mothers.
In talking about social determinants of health, one of the things we always talk about is up to 80% of a young person or any person's health outcomes are going to be addressed by things outside of a hospital's wall.
This is the voice of Nick Jones, VP of Community Wellness at Nationwide Children's Hospital.
So we can provide the best care possible within Nationwide Children's Hospital, but our kids and families are still spending the majority of their time either in their school or in their home or another third place, if you will, where they gather frequently. And so if they don't have access to stable housing that doesn't have exposure to things like mold, or if their parents don't have access to good jobs where they're able to not just earn a living wage, but also not have to work three or four jobs so they don't spend time with their kids, then those are going to exacerbate some potential health outcomes. And one of the best ways to identify the health of a community is looking at its infant mortality rate. And if our, you know, babies are reaching their first birthdays, and so if we don't make those upstream investments in those, then those disparities are going to continue to widen. And there's no coincidence that communities that have high rates of poverty also have high rates of infant mortality. And then going deeper, there's no coincidence that, unfortunately, the impacts of things like racism even create a disparity among Black babies and white babies, take socioeconomic status the same. And so then you overlay that with life expectancy. You know, there's lower life expectancy in lower income communities. So it's why, you know, that all correlates back to health, you know, the impacts that that has on reducing stress and the impacts of that, that you have to make those investments upstream so that that care you do provide in the walls is not the determinant really for long-term health and just living a healthy lifestyle, or life, I should say, not lifestyle.
That was a great answer. I don't really have much to add other than to say, so we have all these, you know, research that talks about like the correlation between those things. We don't know the exact causation. And I think that's one of the answers people want to know, especially for an issue like infant mortality. They want to know, what is the one thing we need to do to fix this problem? And it's complex. And a lot of these social determinants are intertwined with each other. And so we don't know like what is the exact lever we need to pull to get the outcomes that we want. But we do have some work that talks about like the stress, and that might be the mediating factor between, you know, having or living in an area with high vacancy rates and high crime rates and having a poor health outcome. It might be that stress piece that those things kind of bring.
When you say that, it reminds me of some conversations I've had throughout the years when I was reporting on the issue of infant mortality. About the idea of epigenetic mm-hmm. stress. Is that the term?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or epigenetics in general, yep.
Yeah, and how, you know, generations of people who have lived through these policies and who live currently now are carrying within them this level of stress that is impacting the health of their children, specifically because of structural racism. Can you speak to that? Because, you know, you use the terms race neutral and race based in your paper, and I want to get to the root of why we need race based policies.
Yep. So I want to start with the conversation of epigenetics to say that I am always very cautious of conversations around epigenetics.
Oh, okay.
And I think I'm cautious because there is what we have to. People don't always dig deep enough to understand it, right? So you hear genetics and you feel like, well, it gets us close to this narrative that we have these disparities because of biological reasons, which is not true.
Yeah.
And I think we have to be really conscious that when we talk about epigenetics, we're talking about your environment turning on and off your genes So yeah, your environment can turn on and off your genes. It's kind of the basis of epigenetics. And I'm not an expert in this topic. I want to also make that very clear. But I'm cautious because I think that it can easily be our scapegoat to why we haven't fixed this problem. That like, yeah, it's inherited for generations and like there's not much we can do about it. But when we again say that really it's about your environment and how it, you know, turns things on and off and genetically, then we can change the environment that can have some impact on that process in your body.
It speaks to the necessity to change the environment in order to prevent this continuation.
Right. But I think we just have to be really cautious to not just say that the issue is biological and
that's
therefore fair. There's something that we can do.
Thanks for pointing that out.
So I just want to always, that's my little gripe about epigenetics.
Sure.
In terms of like race-based and race neutral, it's really, I just want to also emphasize that our work is really trying to figure out if if having this race conscious, which just really means that when we make decisions, we are explicitly talking about race and we are explicitly addressing racism. And that sounds great, and it is great. The reality is that might not be the way that we can actually do things. There are sometimes consequences of having race or racism in the forefront in terms of our relationships, in terms of dollars. And so we have to be practical about what we do. And so our research is really asking the question of, if we have a race-conscious initiative that really says, hey, here's this history of racism for these different communities, and we take that to the folks making investments, does that change how we invest? And maybe the answer is no. And that no doesn't have to be something negative, right? That no could be, it doesn't change how we're investing because we were already investing in ways that were addressing those things. Mm-hmm. And so the work that we're doing right now, you know, with this paper and, you know, collecting this data, we're doing interviews with Black birthing people in the Linden community as well to kind of, you know, coincide with that history, is to say, does knowing all of these things change the way we invest or change outcomes? And we don't know the answer. And so that's kind of what we're trying to test in this research studies. Does it have an impact?
At this time, it seems like investing in programs to address our infant and maternal mortality rates is a priority for state and federal leaders. Given recent administration changes, it's unclear how funding may change. But Dr. Barnett says, at least for now, substantial funding is there.
So infant mortality, the state is absolutely committed to addressing this issue. A lot of our different programmatic programs to address infant mortality are funded by the state. So we get a lot of funding from, even us as a hospital, we get funding from the state to run some of our programming. The governor has different initiatives towards that. So there is, because even it's not just a Franklin County issue. It's a national issue. It's also an Ohio issue, our Black infant mortality. You know, some news just came out recently that our partners in Cincinnati have done a really good job at decreasing their Black infant mortality. And I know some folks from our hospital and others are, you know, planning a trip down to Cincinnati to have some talks with some folks. And
what are you guys doing?
Yeah, what do we need to replicate here to get the outcomes that you've seen? And so there's a lot of effort and funding around the state to do that, and at a federal level as well. If you think about it from a research perspective of what are we doing, I mean, NIH funds a lot of the research that helps us kind of get to some of these root causes to figure out, again, what do we need to do and change about our communities, about our healthcare systems, about all the things that go into this outcome. So there is some effort to, you know, see progress in the outcomes.
Locally, we have efforts like Celebrate One, a City of Columbus program which aims to reduce preterm births, improve prenatal and postpartum care, address the social determinants of health, and promote safe sleep practices. And Healthy Neighborhoods, Healthy Families, which I mentioned at the top of the episode, is through Nationwide Children's Hospital. Originating on the south side of Columbus in 2008, Healthy Neighborhoods, Healthy Families leads a five-pronged effort involving affordable housing, education, health and wellness, community enrichment, and economic development to change community health outcomes. In 2021, it expanded to the Linden area.
First and foremost, again, is our advisory council. So when we started on the south side, we really worked with one kind of community partner to help be the conduit between the community and the hospital. We have to have a direct relationship with the community if we want to ensure success for our investments and programs in the long term. And so that advisory council really allowed us to have a direct communication with the community, where we have decision makers from the hospital at the table, and then community members, and then a third party facilitating those meetings. So it's not us doing that, but it's a third party bringing us together as equals to hold really each other accountable for what we're doing.
That third party is community organizer Cohere, based in Cincinnati.
Secondly, our housing kind of makeup changed 7-8 years ago, in that we added the rental component to what we had to offer, because like Linden, the South Side was a predominantly rental community. And so if we're going to provide these affordable options and don't have a rental component to that, then we're unfortunately going to miss out on a large population of folks who, you know, should be able to you know, take part in what we have to offer. So rental is the biggest part of our housing program now, and that's what we were able to add in Linden at a faster, you know, clip, if you will, than if we just focused on home ownership. All three components, home ownership, home repair, and rental, are critical to ensuring that affordability, but just kind of diversity. But that was a big pivot. And then third, really is our shift to this economic development space, really focusing on not just the individual piece, but also supporting what future development, like along Cleveland Avenue, might look like. We have to have spaces and opportunity in communities like Linden and the South Side where all folks can go to spend their money and certainly thrive. So that, I think those three things have been big in our work in Linden.
The material improvements seen in Healthy Neighborhoods, Healthy Families South Side initiative will hopefully be duplicated in Linden.
Housing, pun intended, certainly is the foundation for our work, but housing also cannot be done in a vacuum. Other programs or pieces have to come alongside it to ensure that folks are able to realize their hopes, dreams, and aspirations. And so with that said, though, one of the main changes that we've seen on the South Side is the reduction in vacancy rate. When we first started our housing work, we were in a census tract that had the highest foreclosure rate in back to 2008 of any census tract in Franklin County. And we've seen that census tract now fall below Columbus MSA's vacancy rate. And so that certainly is something that's important when we talk about some of the reasons for doing this work. Living in communities that have vacant and blighted housing can certainly add to stress and traumatic experiences, maybe because of incidents of violence and other things. The second thing is with the violence piece, there has been some reduction in property crime violence since that investment. Obviously, that's ebbed and flowed, and certainly through COVID and other things, those change, but that's been one. And then, again, on the health side, we've seen a reduction in ED utilization, which has been certainly not solely due to housing. Like I said, you know, other programs need to come alongside that. And so that's why we have things like school health clinics, where we make access more accessible. We make it more accessible for kids to receive the care that they need, and also in a preventative way, so that they're not using, you know, the ED for unnecessary type of reasons. And why we have like a school-based asthma therapy program. So those pieces are certainly ones that we've wanted to look at. We have seen some reduction of mortality rates on the South Side. And so I think all of those things we want to see in Linden. But again, these aren't going to happen overnight. Kiara's paper highlights that the impacts that decades of policy and practice have had on communities like Linden are going to take decades to address. And so we're certainly using a measurement framework to look at those long-term effects that have process metrics that let us know if we're on the right track or not. But most importantly, the community is going to let us know if we are or are not.
One framework in use is the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion's Healthy People Data Tool. Updated every decade, Healthy People sets thresholds for bettering health outcomes related to a range of topics, from specific illnesses like cancer, diabetes, and chronic pain, to public health infrastructure, schools, and transportation, to environmental health, economic stability, and violence prevention. Healthy People 2030 set a goal to decrease the rate of infant mortality to 5 of every 1,000 babies born.
It's unfortunate, but it is across the country that most places aren't meeting that threshold for infant mortality specifically. In that, for reference, Healthy People also have a lot of different measures. So it's not just infant mortality. It's across a wide spectrum of health outcomes that we kind of set the goal of this is what we want to hit. I will say for Franklin County, we actually have hit that goal a good 10 years ago for white infants. We've hit that goal for white infants, I think going back to 2012 or 2014. So like well before the our mark, we've hit that goal. For our black infants, we have not. And we are still almost three times that goal for our black infants. And so still have a long ways to go. But I think, you know, the bright side of it is that we recognize. We're not trying to really hide the fact that we haven't hit that goal for our Black infants specifically. And there's a lot of different initiatives happening. Going back to our conversation earlier, resource rich, systems poor. There's a lot of different initiatives addressing infant mortality. Again, as I mentioned, the issue itself is complex. We don't know what's the one thing we need to do. There's multiple things that we need to do, housing being one of those like foundational things that we need to address. And I said to say that there's a lot of effort going to try to get us closer to that goal.
We've seen some effective pilot programs, like Healthy Beginnings at Home, which was a study that placed 150 pregnant women from Franklin County, who were previously housing unstable, in safe, stable housing to determine how it would impact their pregnancies.
We saw positive impacts from that program of housing folks who were pregnant and having housing instability. So that is very helpful. I will say that, and again, it's important that we do the work. That work requires lots of advocacy because, you know, paying for people to have a stable house is expensive. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it because we absolutely should. Like, people should have a stable place. It's worth the money. but going back to, like, the outcomes, when we think about infant mortality, we're talking about a population level thing. And so, but then when we get down to these programs, we're seeing impact in the 150 women that were served by this program. And then you'll have folks who will look at the population level outcome and say, well, we didn't see a shift. Well, yeah, because we were helping the 150 who got access to this program. And we are seeing, you know, differences in that group. Now, if you want to scale it up, then we can see population level difference. We'll take that money and we'll see population differences. So I think having that understanding of like what the difference between an individual program and a population level outcome and the lag between serving, you know, if we served 150 this year and then next year another 150, over time we will see that population change, but it just takes time.
Yeah. There's value, I guess, yeah, in running those pilots, but they're probably not scalable.
Not under the current funding available.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need more advocacy and funding to do that. But like you said, it's worth the investment. And I also want to acknowledge that it is also worth the investment, yes, for infant mortality, but also just for humanity in general. But I've heard women talk about the way that they feel that people only care about them because they're pregnant. They are incubators of these babies. And we only want to give them housing because they're pregnant. Yes, it is important that we house pregnant people so that they can, you know, have a healthy pregnancy and deliver healthy babies, but also for just their own health and well-being as a person is important to be housed. I think we need to not lose sight of that too, that we don't have to just have these programs for folks that are pregnant, folks that are not. And honestly, go back to epigenetics. All of these things are impacting a woman's body that are, you know, feeding into this cycle of epigenetics before she's ever conceived.
Yeah.
And so really it's about how do we get them housing and how do we lower that stress before conception?
And I'll just say again why it's important to have other programs alongside the housing piece, because that's just one aspect of what a mom, you know, might need. And if you look at our rental portfolio, in Linden, the majority of renters we have are single moms. And when we look at job training programs, we may get, you know, a mom a job, but she may have to turn it down because of the impact of the benefits cliff, and that she'll lose her child care subsidy as a result of whatever starting, you know, wage she might be coming in at. So all of these things kind of go together. And if we're not, layering them all in, then, you know, the housing piece and investment like Healthy Beginnings might only be impactful for that first year if we're not kind of having a plan for what that long-term support needs to look like.
A statement I heard a long time ago in a meeting, I can't credit it who said it, but here in Columbus or Franklin County, we are resource-rich but systems poor. And I will say, I think that we've made some strides in recent years to try to create that better system. So all the partners that we have that are, we're all working towards similar problems, if not the same problem. And I think we're doing a better job in recent years of trying to collaborate our efforts so that we actually can see the progress we want to see.
It's funny that you said resource-rich, system-poor, because I had Steve Skavensky on last month from Community Shelter Board, and he said the exact same thing. And now I'm going to ask one of you to tell me what that means.
Yeah. I mean, it really means exactly what it sounds like, so that we have a ton of resources. There are a lot of organizations who are doing work to get us to, you know, to address this issue, the different issues. So whether it's housing, whether it's maternal or child health, a lot of folks are working towards this problem. Systems poor really means that there is sometimes not a coordinated effort. I could tell a story of someone. We, as researchers, were trying to find where a mom can go to get formula for her infant. And here we are, we kind of made a joke. It's not a joke, but we made a joke around, like, you know, how many people with degrees does it take to find where you can access free formula in Franklin County? And, you know, ultimately we bought the formula ourselves, or got access to it in a way. But the fact that the way that people have to navigate all those resources, it's not as simple as, I have this need, here's this one place, or even, you know, two places that I can go to get those needs met. They kind of have to navigate these different systems that oftentimes don't talk to each other. And so, you know, one of the innovations that we have going on here in Franklin County is our community information exchange. So that's, you know, in the infancy of it, but that's supposed to help us kind of connect systems so that people don't have to walk through a million doors to get access to the resources that they need, that they can have a one-stop shop and get connected to different resources.
Anything to add?
No.
I was going to say, I'm like, what's the solution to that? Because it can't be another organization.
It can't be another organization. No. So, yeah, having a system that can talk to one another, having a uniform application that folks can fill out to get access to those resources would be really great.
While the goalposts for things like community health can always be moved to encourage improvement, my guests today believe Columbus is overall headed in the right direction when it comes to addressing broader community health trends with targeted and diverse solutions.
I think Columbus certainly is well positioned. I think we've certainly done a lot of good. I think we're kind of navigating another stage or iteration of that with all of the growth we're going through, and ensuring that everybody can realize or can thrive in that growth. And so we're certainly a long way off from that. But as I said earlier, the resources are there, the good partners are there, like Homeport, to do that. And so if we can collectively come together and recognize that, you know, we shouldn't have two Columbuses, that we should have one Columbus for all to thrive, you know, we'll hopefully get us to where we need to go.
Level With Us is brought to you by Homeport and is recorded, mixed, and edited by Lauren Sega. All sources are in the show notes. Homeport creates strong communities by developing quality, affordable homes on a cornerstone of dignity, security, and opportunity. To learn more, or if you'd like to support our mission, visit us at homeportohio.org.